Welcome to Finding My Religion. My name is Miles Phelps. Hey, are you following us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all that good stuff? If not, do that. Please, we want to engage with you. You can find all the links to that stuff in the show notes, so please go check that out. And also, make sure to stick around after this show for a sneak peek of episode 4. All right. I have been waiting for this conversation. This conversation feels like it's like 10 years overdue. Joe Ross joining me here. We were talking before we started recording that I think last time you and I even, you know, had communication face-to-face like this was before you even had kids, and now you have a senior in college. Is that what it is?
That is correct.
That's crazy. That's unbelievable. How you been, man?
I'm good, buddy. Time flies when you're having fun.
Definitely does. So a little background. Joe, I think you're the first person that I've had on this podcast that has gone to, that went to the same church that I grew up in that wasn't a family member. So it's going to be an interesting conversation because you're not affiliated with that church any longer. You've had your own spiritual journey, which is extremely interesting. So I'm excited to get into that. But I think the biggest thing that I wanted to first start off with was that you are a very caring person. I remember when my dad was going through his struggles, kind of like the first round of alcoholism and had his problems with some other things. You were the first person that showed up and like would take me out golfing. You would take me out to lunch. He was like, "Hey man, how you doing?" So it's just awesome to talk to somebody that no matter what we might not be at the same points in our faith journey, but it's just so cool to talk to somebody that like I knew always had my back, even as a kid. So I appreciate you having the willingness to do this.
I still have your back now. I promise.
I appreciate that.
I love your father like a brother. I still do. I'm sad that our lives have taken us in different directions and I don't see him. Saw him a few years ago at Pumpkin Fest and it was like greeting an old friend, but the conversation ended abruptly and it was, you know, we kind of went our separate ways, but I keep telling myself I should reach out. I know he still golfs, you know, "Hey man, you want to go golf? You want to go, you know, have breakfast?" And like you and I spoke, life gets in the way. You know, the silly symptoms of adulthood.
Absolutely. That's well put. Yeah. Dad's doing well. He's golfing. He's in a league now at Bliss Creek. But I think I got him addicted to it. He's got the bug now. He's got like all the gadgets and working on his game. I got him some lessons a couple years ago. So I still kick his ass. So he's trying to work up to where I am.
Not that we're here to talk about golf, but my golf story is that in 2001, I played 127 rounds of golf.
Holy hell.
Wow. I was an executive chef at a private club in the suburbs. And man, I played 5-6 times a week. I was constantly playing golf. My son was born in May of 2002, and I bet you I haven't played 12 rounds of golf since 2002. I'm up to like 3 this year. So
hey, that's better than nothing.
The bug is bad.
Better than nothing. I keep telling my wife, like, I play a lot now, and I know that it's not a forever thing. So at some point, we possibly want to have kids. And now it's like, all right, let's take advantage of it as much as I can to her chagrin. But it's a passion. But
she's not into it?
She more so would like to just kind of ride the cart and have a couple of Bloody Marys, which is great. And I'll invite her to do that every now and then. But I'm very competitive. So I like to win. And play 18 holes, the whole 18 yes. Versus just, you know, cutting out at 9. So it doesn't usually match with what she wants to do. But she'll get out with me a couple times a year. Let's do it. Let's get on the schedule. Well, cool. Well, let's talk about why you're here. So I always start this with like, where are you at today, Joe? What's your faith? What's your religion?
My faith has evolved to... Basically, I'm an Evangelical Lutheran Church of America member. I struggle with the fact that I don't go to church much at all. Though last year I was able to lead one of my daughter's confirmation groups, so I was there every Wednesday, but felt like a hypocrite because Sunday morning came and I went, "I guess I'll go make breakfast." But my faith is that I am a Christian. I believe in God solely. I believe he sent his son to die for our sins. I struggle, and I'm sure we'll get into it later, with the, you know, what religion has evolved or devolved into in this country, and what Jesus probably really valued more than what they're teaching in churches that he valued, right? Mm-hmm. But I consider myself a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, and I help out at the church whenever they need me. I just don't regularly attend services.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people would say that's okay. Like it's not a, you know, I don't consider myself in the Christian faith anymore, but I think like, you know, church is there when you need it. And however you're celebrating that, whatever you believe is great. So, let's back up though. Cause I mean, you have a very interesting journey. And one that I've been really, really excited to hear about, or excited might be the wrong word, but just intrigued. So, I mean, talk about how you grew up, because you grew up in a completely different religion.
I did. I've passed through a couple of forms. So I was born in Camden, South Carolina, and I was raised in a predominantly Southern Baptist family. So there was no card playing. There was no rock and roll music. There were no games of chance. There was... You know, it was a pretty straightforward and staid life. I did not like it, but I was a child, right? So what child likes being forced to go to church every Sunday and dress up? And after church, we went to Oma's house for a picnic and food. And Oma was a very staunch German woman, didn't speak a lot of English. Loved smacking me in the back of the head with a wooden spoon. Very much child abuse as we know it now, but at that time it was abuse that was delivered with love, if that makes any sense. All I know is I didn't care for it. But little did I know, life was going to throw me a curveball. And that was when I was about 7. My mom found the Jehovah's Witnesses. And boy, oh boy, I went to from not wanting to go to church on Sundays to not wanting to go to church on Sundays, Tuesdays, or Thursdays, and not wanting to go door to door on Saturdays, and not wanting to go door to door on Sundays after church. It was a constant, and I mean constant, pressure in our lives. I think my mom enjoyed having a purpose. My mom was always, so backing up a little bit, I grew up in a single family household. My mom raised 3 boys by herself and she worked her ass off. She was a welder at an electric motor factory. That was her main job. She also, in addition to that, worked as a cashier at a gas station and a certified nurse's assistant at a nursing home. So much of my childhood between the ages of about 4 and 9 was kind of a latchkey kid. I remember getting off the bus and letting myself into the house and mom will have left me a note on what I had to do. My mom needed people. She had a lot of boyfriends in that time. She was constantly looking for companionship, and not finding it. So I think when the Jehovah's Witnesses came around, that was kind of a way for her to latch on to something that was tangible, something that drove a relationship into her life. Because what, and to that point, she had found the one boyfriend that she had, you know, to her surprise, was abusive to me physically.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And that kind of torpedoed that. And she needed something, and the Jehovah's Witnesses offered that. And then that is where I spent from, about 8 or 9 years old, until I told them to get bent when I was right before I turned 18. And I am considered a disfellowshipped member of the Jehovah's Witnesses. When they show up at the door and I tell them that, it ends the conversation relatively quickly. But it also almost ensures that I'm going to get a phone call or a visit from one of the elders of the congregation, you know, shortly thereafter to let me know that Jehovah hasn't forgotten about me and I'm welcome to come back, but I have to do some things for that.
Did you ever talk to your mom about like what was the key thing that drew her into that? Like what was appealing for that and how did she get to that point?
So before you and I actually started recording, if you remember, I referred to it as a cult. Mm-hmm. My mom could not get it out of her head that what they said about their interpretation of the Bible was the gospel. Mm-hmm. What they believed regarding the Bible, and they have a very literal translation of the Bible that they use, stopping just short of stoning people. You just couldn't tell her anything different, Miles. It was almost like speaking to someone with autism, in that she could only look one direction. And if you tried to deviate from what she was thinking, the whole train would go off the tracks. But she loved that faith beyond anything I've ever seen. I mean, she attacked it vociferously, and it was, you know, for a while I loved it. When it went sideways for me is when I gained critical thinking skills. And they didn't like that much, because they more liked, you know, you to shut up and obey. But yeah, I never did get an answer from her. She just believes it is the truth. She believes that their Bible is the actual interpretation of the Bible, and that the other versions like the King James Version and the New International Version, that they have all omitted passages or changed words, and that God wouldn't like that. They had some out there beliefs that I just couldn't bring myself to. I couldn't reconcile in my brain that a God of love would want those sorts of things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I mean, you call it a cult, and I think it mainstream religious scholars are leaning more towards that. And from what I've, you know, I've watched a couple of documentaries on Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm no expert, but it just feels like they are taking away that critical thinking aspect of it, which is like a telltale sign of a cult of just believe. What got her into that? Was it someone going door to door, or like how did she find it?
It wasn't someone going door to door with her. It was someone going door to door with her sister, my Aunt Margaret. And then my Aunt Margaret, you know, Barbara, you need to talk to these people. And then we started going, and my Aunt Margaret stopped going. So I it's almost like, here, hand the baton off. But it was, yeah, she sent some door to door for, you know, you need to go talk to my sister, sent them to talk to my mother. And the next thing I know, I'm in church, for 2 hours on Sunday, an hour on Tuesday, and 2 hours on Thursday every week.
That's insane. So you mentioned, 7 years old, you liked it at first. What did you like about it? Like what was fun as a kid?
What any kid likes about church. I made friends there. And it was my, you know, friends that didn't go to the same school as me. So, you know, friends that lived in Milton, Kentucky, and Madison, Indiana, and Vivi, Indiana, and, you know, the surrounding small farming communities that I would never have met had I not gone to the Kingdom Hall. And they were good kids. And it's funny now, I still talk to a couple of them from time to time. And one of my closest friends will not give me the time of day because he is still, he's an elder in their congregation and, you know, has zero use for me as a disfellowship person. But I got to see my friends, and that's what kept me going. And then if you don't know this about Jehovah's Witnesses, they have people in the congregation get up and speak often to the congregation. Tuesday night was kind of like a Bible study night. Thursday was more along the lines of Sunday. There was a church the first hour, and then the second hour was where you knew it was coming weeks in advance, but for instance, they would have me get up and read a Bible verse, right? And then as I read the Bible verse, I was to talk to the congregation about how I interpreted that verse, right? Whether it was right or not, but how I interpreted that verse. And I am the baby of the family. I have always loved attention. And I think that's where they got their hooks in me, was when they said, here, read this verse. And there's 250 people in front of me, and I'm shaking like a dog shitting peach seeds. But the first time I did it and got through it, and the number of people that came up afterwards and said, Joey, you did a really good job. That was very nice. I was done. I was hooked. I actually did a Bible verse like that. And, you know, I forget exactly what they called it, but a talk about that Bible verse at a district convention of Jehovah's Witnesses at Freedom Hall in Louisville, Kentucky, in front of about 10,000 people. And I was 12, I think, when I did that. And that was just a rush beyond. But now I'm 52. I've never had an issue public speaking in my life. And I thank them for that, because that is what that got me, was just absolute zero fear of speaking in public in front of large groups, small groups. It doesn't matter. I can soft shoe and talk to anyone.
So I assume then the door-to-door thing was not scary for you.
Not only was it not scary, when I got baptized as a Jehovah's Witness, which happened when I was 10 or 11, they make you go through a whole course to get baptized. You can't just say, I profess my love of the Lord and get baptized. There's like a class you go to over and over and over. And,
is there an age you have to be for that?
I don't recall. So yeah, any answer I would give you would be, you know, just off the top of my head. I don't,
we'll Google it.
I do remember thinking though, when they were going to disfellowship me, how upset I was that I didn't know what I was getting into when I got into it.
Oh, interesting.
That was one of my arguments against the board of elders, was, you know, you baptized me at 10. I'm not exactly sure that's the number, but we'll use that for conversation. You baptized me at 10. I had no idea what I was getting into. And now you're going to disfellowship me at 17, because I have determined that what you're telling me is a bunch of bullshit, and you can't give me an answer. And when I dig into the questions, your answer is, it is my job to just believe. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's got me in trouble before. I'm not doing that again. So, but yeah, it was that's how it rolled. So the pioneering thing is, so door to door every weekend, but you had the ability in the summer to be what they called a pioneer. Okay. And it was either 90 or 120 hours of door to door in 3 months. So either 30 hours a month or 40 hours a month. I don't remember what it was. And when I think I was 12 when they gave me I think you had to be 12 to be a pioneer. And they offered me the option, and I was all in. And I remember, you know, I zero issues. Hi, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to bring the Lord Jesus to you.
Right.
And it was weird because it might have been 10% of the people that were not receptive, but were kind. Right. They may not have been receptive, but they were nice enough to, they would sit there and listen, and then they might ask a question, and they would let you leave your Watchtower and Awake magazines with them. Now, we were supposed to charge, I want to say it's like 50 cents that we were supposed to charge to give them the magazines, but we were always told
that.
If
That's
they
funny.
Don't want to pay, or if they don't have the money to pay, we give them the Word of God for free. We're just looking to help offset the costs. Right. Mm-hmm. I do remember, as clear as day, Miles, going up, and we're in the hills of southern Indiana. We go up this long driveway to a little house. It's in the middle of the woods, middle of nowhere. I was with a Jehovah's Witness by the name of Bob Manning. And he and I get out of the car, and there is an older fella sitting on the porch, and he racks a shotgun. And he says, I ain't buying nothing. And I turned to Bob Manning and I said, Brother Manning, we can get back in the car and go. And he kind of shushed me with his hand, kind of waved me off. And he goes, Well, now, friend, we're not selling anything. And the old man says, what are you here for? And he says, we are wanting to know whatever the opening, they changed like your opening. They don't want to, it's not about the good news of Jesus. It might have just been a question for that month or that week, right? But, you know, for lack of a better term, we're just here to talk to you about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And he racks it again and says, you know, I've already got religion. Get your ass back in your car, head down the end of the laneway, and don't come back. And I'm hand on the car door. And I hear Bob Manning go, well, now why do you feel that way? I'm thinking, this dude is obviously not here for debate. Yeah. You know, when we got back in the car and we got down to the bottom to the road, he chastised me for giving up early. And all I could think of in my little head was he had a fucking shotgun. But that ends the discussion. Right. If you've got a gun and I don't have a gun,
yeah,
and I have no anger in my heart towards you to use a gun, even if I had one.
Right.
Let's go home.
What are we doing here?
We're on his property. He doesn't want us on his property. He's racked the shotgun in our faces and told us he's going to put them in us. I don't want to meet Jesus yet. You know, I'd like to meet him 80 years from now. So it was, that's what it was, man. And I'll never forget it. And I made it my 90 or 120 hours, whatever it was. I made it that summer. Because I remember if you did it as a teenager or whatever, they took everybody to Kings Island, which is kind of like a Six Flags, Kings Island in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I made it and I got to go to Kings Island. And, as a kid that really had no money to his name, getting to go to Kings Island, everything paid for was, you know, that was a big reward for me. So
yeah, absolutely.
I was glad I did it.
Well, my next question for you is going to be, what's the craziest story you have going door to door, but we got that check mark. Yep, so
that is it, my friend, shotgun what? Racking. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, I don't know how you could. So you mentioned that you started to kind of fall out of it once you became to the age of critical thinking. Like what sort of things specifically were popping up? What questions did you start to have or concerns did you have?
Sure. We had a member of our congregation, and I'm ashamed that I can't remember his name, but I'll just blame it on old age, was in an automobile accident, and the word was that he was possibly going to need a blood transfusion to save his life. And I remember we were all at the church, and my mother was talking to a couple of the elders about it, and they said, well, you know, that's out of the question. And his wife was there, and his wife was like, that's what I told him. You know, if Jehovah calls him home, Jehovah calls him home. There's, and I said, wait a minute. I was 16, maybe. It also doesn't help that at this time I found the love of a woman, and the sins of the flesh were gripping me tightly, or I was gripping me tightly and thinking about the sins of the flesh. But it blew my mind that this woman who loved this man was willing to let him die, because, and I told you, they have a very literal translation of the Bible. So in the book of Acts, chapter 15, verses 28 and 29, it talks about that you should abstain from things that are unclean or unpure. And one of the things it talks about is blood. And Charles Taze Russell, who founded Jehovah's Witness, they used to call it Russellism, C.T. Russell determined that to mean, you know, no blood at all. So a blood transfusion was going against the word of the Bible. So it disturbed me, and I acted out a little bit at home, because that was when I first started thinking, holy shit, this is a sham, right? Why would a God that you're telling me loves us, created us in his image, wants us to be happy, why would he want that to end when the knowledge that he's given us to create a blood transfusion to save the life that you say is precious is not allowed? Mm-hmm. We turn somewhere, and I didn't know where. And I got into so much trouble with my mother. We were so angry with each other that she asked the elders to intervene on her behalf about my behavior. So that following Sunday, after church and after Sunday school, they came to me and they said, you know, we'd like to talk to you, you know, back in whatever the room was, like the boardroom. And I went back there and they said, your mother says you've been acting out and that you don't think that this is for you. You know, we'd like you to explain yourself. Those were his words. The guy's name was McConnell, and his words were, you need to explain yourself. And I said, no, you need to explain yourself. And my mom was Joey. She was pearl clutching, and my stepfather was clenching his fists. And I said, that just what I just told you, we're created in his image. He loves us. He wants us to be loved, right? You tell me suicide is bad, that we are not respecting our body if we commit suicide, but you're allowing him to commit suicide by not accepting blood. That's two different things, and you can't give me an answer. And we went around and around. Miles, it was like, I don't even know what it was like. It was arguing with a wall. Their answer was, sometimes you just have to accept that it's God's will. And I just would not accept that. And I finally, I flipped my chair over and I walked out. And as I was walking out, my stepfather tried to grab my arm and I jerked my arm away. And I said, you touch me again, we're going to have it right here. And they let me go. And it wasn't long after that that they voted for me to be disfellowshipped. But I was just really, really, really angry about
that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're at a pivotal time in your life when you, like you said, you're starting to do critical thinking. And if something doesn't make sense, you might not have the tools to rationalize even what the correct response to that would be.
Absolutely.
It's got to be so tough as a kid. So you mentioned this phrase disfellowship a couple of times, and I think I understand a little bit what it means, but like what specifically goes into that? Like, is there like a little black book essentially that you're on for Jehovah's Witness?
Hearings, you know, they have these little hearings and I'm supposed to plead my case. And when we had the actual hearing, and I was basically told that I could recant what I had said and accept that the word of Jehovah was the word of Jehovah and to be followed at all costs, or I was going to be disfellowshipped. And my mom is, Miles, I'm not exaggerating when I say she was sitting in the corner sobbing.
Oh, wow.
Like she was watching me die.
How many people were in this room?
10, 12, maybe. Like I think there were 7 elders. Maybe there were more. And then, you know, my stepfather, my mom, a couple of other folks, and I said, I'm sorry, brothers. I can't in good conscience give you what you want. Because you tell me lying's bad and now you're asking me to lie. Mm-hmm. There's
right.
Misdirection all over this thing. You know, what do you guys, you know, I know what you want. I'm not going to give it to you. Where does that leave us? And they said, well, that leaves it with you're going to be disfellowshipped, which means you won't be able to talk to your friends. You know, when you come here, you'll have to sit by yourself. You know, the exact opposite of what a church family is supposed to feel like. Right. But that was their decision. And I was 17 when that happened. And I want to say it was in the summer. I'm racking my brain here for some details that are fuzzy at this point. And then I turned 18 in February and immediately joined the United States Navy on my 18th birthday.
Oh, wow.
I was so ready to be done with everything about that town, my mom's relationships, the past abuses, the church, you know, it just, that town held nothing. I was a high school dropout. I had gone completely sideways, in high school and, I needed a fresh start. So I joined the United States Navy and got that start.
Wow. Did you reconcile with your mom at some point, or what was that relationship like from that point on?
My mother was a wonderful lady, and there was never anything to reconcile. What I had to put up with was every time she saw me, just eventually in the conversation, a hand on my arm, "Joey, you know you're missed, and you know that I want you to be with me in a paradise on earth, and you're not going to be unless you repent and you come back to the congregation." And she would tear up. She was determined that she's going to be one of the people that turns the earth into a paradise. And those of us that were, you know, us ne'er-do-wells were going to be cat. They don't believe in hell. They believe that hell is a mankind's common grave, right? So, there is no hell, because a God that loves you wouldn't torture you. You just go to sleep and you cease to exist. And that, you know, then there's 144,000 anointed ones that will reign in heaven. And the rest of the believers would be brought back and would be tasked with turning the earth back into the paradise that it was when Adam and Eve were first put here. That was the belief. And so every time I saw her, it was, I really want you to come back. You know, we miss you. And every once in a while, when she'd send me a letter because I lived away or whatnot, I would get a, you know, so-and-so says hello. They really miss seeing you, and, you know, tugging it at sentimentality and heartstrings, and you know, and when we'd talk about it on the phone, and when she'd get on it, I'd say, "Mom, God, I love you so much. I owe you so much, but you and I are never going to see eye to eye on faith. It's just not going to happen." So yeah, there wasn't, she didn't hold it against me. She didn't. I do know that they pressured her to cut off ties with me completely.
Oh, really?
She told me that they had pressure, you know, "Barbara, you know, you're sinning. He's moved on. He's no longer living under your roof. So you really shouldn't fellowship with him. Disfellowship means that. You shouldn't see him at all." And my mom was basically like, "Well, that is the one thing that will cause me to draw a line between my faith is I was her baby. And she wasn't going to turn her back on me for all the money in the world."
Wow. That sounds like a special woman. I mean, to have that amount of pressure, you know, and still kind of hold your line there from a family perspective is pretty cool. So, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but I mean, birthdays, did you have a birthday before? I mean,
I think I had a sixth birthday. I have a clear memory of getting a big wheel. For my birthday. It was called a big green machine. Yep. And I remember building a ramp in the street in front of our house and jumping the big wheel and wrecking it on my birthday. Yep. That is the last birthday I ever remember. So no, we didn't have birthdays. A funny story. We also were, again, dirt poor. I don't know how old I was. Maybe 11 or 12. My mom was always a big reader, and we always had a lot of books in the house. She would buy them at secondhand stores or libraries when they wanted to get rid of them. There were hundreds of books. I'm not kidding. It might have been 1,000 books. There were books everywhere. And my next door neighbor was having a birthday party. And my neighbor across the street was like, "You know, I'm getting him this. What are you getting him?" And this was at the age where I didn't really want to talk about my faith because it was making me a little uncomfortable, but, you know, and I said, "Oh, I'm getting him a book." So I went home and I grabbed a book off the shelf and wrapped it, not knowing what the hell I was doing. And I took it over and we had the birthday party and he opened the gifts. And when he got to my book, he kind of handed it to his mom and she's looking at me like, "Who the hell are you?" And then she said, "Joey, I'm gonna walk you home." And she brought my mother to the door and she was like, "You know, Joey brought this over for David's birthday." And my mom was mortified. She says, "You're not supposed to be going to birthday parties. You know this." And I said, "I know. I didn't want to be left out. You know, I was 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever the age was." And she's like, "Well, he gave David this book." And she handed the book to my mom and my mom was like, and the book was called Looking for Mr. Goodbar. And if you haven't read it, or if you don't know anything about it, it is, it's porn. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And here I am giving it to this 10-year-old or whatever, because I wanted to have a birthday gift for him. And yeah. And his mom was just mortified. And then my mom was mortified. She had forgotten she even had it. You know, she had it pre Jehovah's Witness days.
Right.
Suddenly, the next thing I know, she's going through all the books with a fine-tooth comb and just throwing it. Nope, that one's gone. That one's gone. And I was left basically with James Herriot and Encyclopedia Britannica. That was the end.
That's
of the
hilarious.
Book. But
I mean, you honestly did her a favor. I don't know why we got so mad. If she doesn't want it, you might as well give it away, right? Like, let the kid read it.
You know, let the kid read it. He turns out he had two kids himself, so he knew what to do.
That's funny.
But so no birthdays, no Christmas. You couldn't set aside a day for a person because, in their opinion, that was putting that person above God. And I think that's why now at 52, I still treat Christmas as if I'm eight. I absolutely love Christmas. I love decorating for it. I go absolutely batshit over the top buying gifts for my kids because I didn't get it, you know, and I keep buying them gifts. And, the year we got Blake, it was the year the Wii came out. Blake really wanted a Wii and we just couldn't afford it. And a buddy of mine said, you know what? I've got one and I never play it. You want to give me $100? I'll give you the Wii, the two games I got, the controllers. And we're like, yes. You know, the look on his face he just about passed out. And I mean, we were Mario Karting it shortly after that. And it was hooked for both of us ever since. I get such a jazz out of Christmas, man. I'm buying gifts for everybody. And it drives Vicky nuts because she's like, you know, one day we'd like to retire and have some of this money to retire. I just can't. Yeah, I go over the top now. I just can't do it. You know, well, I don't think we're putting us above God. Let's just roll.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's important for kids, too. I mean, it doesn't have to be from a religious aspect either. It's just like, you know, you're important, you know, and that's, I think that's kind of what your background is just making sure people feel special, which I think is so cool. All right. So we leave Jehovah's Witnesses. We go join the Navy. When did you start to find a religion again? Like what brought you back into the fold?
August 2nd, 1990.
Is that your wedding date?
No.
Okay. The date you met Becky?
Nope. That's the day Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Okay.
My ship was about 20 miles off the coast of Kuwait when Iraq invaded and we
went to
general quarters and we didn't know what it was for at the time. We were just all, like 3 a.m, all hands man your battle stations. And we were there all day. And I remember sitting there, they gave us a lunch, which was, basically a bologna sandwich and an apple. I forget, you know, whatever we had to drink. And I remember my, battle station at that point was, a fire station. I was on a hose team for firemen. And, I remember sitting there eating a sandwich and I looked to my right and there was a, God, I cannot remember his name, but there was a sailor to my right and he had his eyes closed and he was mouthing something. And then he crossed himself. And started eating his food. And I thought, so this would have been, I would have been 19 years old. I hadn't set foot in a church in 3 years. And I thought, you know, if I pray, does God care? I remember thinking that here's this guy, you know, I didn't know the significance of this. Sure. And he was praying fervently. And I remember thinking, you know, who the hell would I pray to? Right. I haven't told God. This is where, you know, I told you before we recorded some of the confusion that I have, right, stems from Christian guilt, right? Mm. You have to go to church. You have to go to church. You have to show God you love him. You have to tithe 10% of your income to God to show him you love him. That guilt fucking pisses me off more than anything on the planet right now, because I honestly don't think God gives a shit if I ever go to church. I don't. Right? I think he thinks if you hold him in your heart and you realize what he's done for you, and you treat people, everybody, with kindness and love and respect, and you try to help those that are lesser than you, that you're doing everything God wants you to do. Mm-hmm. Right? So that guilt that manifested itself fully that morning.
Wow.
It was an epiphany. It was, my God, who do I pray to? I haven't gone to church. Should I pray? Am I allowed to pray? I knew I was on some level, right? That's a stupid question or a stupid thing to think. But there was a part of me that was like, do my prayers even count? And wow. That's what
you went through the whole disfellowed thing. So you were not only disfellowed from your church, but through the thing that you believed in.
Right.
Wow.
And it was a kick in the knockers. It was just an absolute, like I said, it was an epiphany. It was one of those things where you go, I don't want to die. I don't know what's happening here. I don't know if we're going to be under attack, if I'm going to jump on this hose team real quick and be fighting a fire from a torpedo, or you just no idea at that point. And I remember thinking, who do I pray to? Right. And I'll tell you what came about was, once we figured out what was going on and we were in no immediate danger, first of all, you feel a little silly. You're like, oh, I was worried for nothing. But you don't know that it was nothing until you know, right?
War, yeah.
So I remember us getting into Bahrain in the Middle East, and I went down to the quarterdeck, and I said, where can I find? We had a chaplain on our ship, but it was just a dude that was Christian and would lead, you know, like non-denominational services. It was almost like a Bible study if you wanted to do that. And I had not done that, but I had gone to him and I said, I really want to talk to a chaplain, someone who is educated, not in payroll disbursement, which was what this guy did, but educated in faith and theology. And I finally met one. And it was cathartic. There were a lot of tears shed on my behalf, a lot of guilt that I unloaded on him. And he was awesome. We met, I don't know, two or three days in a row, and then the next time we came back into port, we met again. And I was talking to him one day after I had met Vicky, Vicky had told me that she was a Missouri Synod Lutheran and that she had gone to St. John's. But I had told Arlen, you know, Arlen and Mary, I had told Arlen and Mary that I was an agnostic. Right.
Just so for people that don't know, it's your mother-in-law and father-in-law, correct?
That is correct. My wife's parents. And I had remembered when they were grilling me about my faith, and I told them I had grown up as a Jehovah's Witness, but now I was more or less an agnostic. I remember the look on my mother-in-law's face. She wasn't my mother-in-law yet, but you know, on her mom's face that looked like I'd basically, you know, pulled my pants down and chat, right? And she says, well, I don't think you know what that is. I'm like, I do. in talking to him, he said, you know, what are some of the theological questions you have surrounding your faith with the Jehovah's Witnesses? And we went through the main thing, which was the blood transfusion, right?
Right.
And we went through the holidays, and we went through a couple of other things. And I said, you know, my biggest hang up is that Jehovah's Witnesses believe that there is not a triune God, that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are just one. Right. And I said, no one has been able to explain to me how they can be three separate but still be God.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, softball. And he started laughing. And he said, you ever seen a clover? And I said, yeah. And he says, how many leaves on a clover? I said, well, most of them are three. He says, yeah, three separate leaves, one clover. Three separate entities, one God. And I went, wow. And it was such a small, minor thing, thinking back on it now, but it opened my eyes. And I said, if you don't mind, sir, what is your faith? And he said, oh, I'm a Missouri Synod Lutheran. And I was like, that's what Vicky had said. Maybe I'll try that, you know? And then that was it. You know, I'm like, oh, I'll just come to Vicky's side and we'll start there.
Wow.
And so I did.
That's incredible. Just the trajectory of that is fascinating to me. What are your memories just about being at, so we went to a church called St. John's where my dad was a pastor. It's an evangelical Lutheran church, Missouri Synod, which is what you're referring to. But I mean, what, do you have any memories of that place now that you're not there? Anything that sticks out?
Oh God, lots. What are you looking for specifically? That was a very pivotal time in my life, right? I was in my, you know, mid 20s, to early 30s. I was, you know, I went through classes with Pastor DeQuinn, and his beautiful wife, to become a Missouri Synod Lutheran. I taught Sunday school at that church. I became the, what did they call it? The guy that counts the money. I forget.
Oh yeah. I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about? That guy. Yep. I became that guy. What's that?
I can't remember. I know there's a term for it,
though. Yeah. So I became that guy and was with the, you know, the board there, met your dad, fell in love with your dad and your mom immediately. We used to have this couples Bible study, with your dad and mom, Vicky and I, Kent and Sherry Hoffman, old friends. Yep. And then there were, you know, there were five or six other couples, but we kind of peeled off and started this monthly, dinner club. So we would just go out every month, to a different restaurant, and just, you know, eat and drink and have a good time. I remember when I first became disillusioned with organized religion at that church. And yep. they had an associate pastor there. I'm not going to say his name, but he was a farmer out in Rochelle. And he was kind of your dad's right hand man. Mm-hmm. We had had a function at church, and it was an election year. So this would have been 96. Yeah.
Maybe probably later than that. I think we were there. We got there around 2000, so it had to have been.
Then it would have been the 2000 election. 2000. Yeah, yeah, the 2000 election. And the topic came around to who are you going to vote for? And they asked me, and I said, well, I'm voting for Al Gore. And they said, why would you vote for Al Gore? And I said, well, because he cares about this planet that God has given us. And wants to do some things to reverse what we've screwed up over the centuries. And I had some other things, but what struck me was that pastor, I turned the question to him. I said, well, who are you voting for? Cause he seemed astounded that I would vote for Al Gore.
Right.
And he said, well, I'm voting for George Bush. And I said, why? And he said, because George Bush is against abortion. Right. And I said, well, okay, what else? And he said, that's it. That's the only thing. That's the only thing to care about. And I said, so we're not supposed to care about the poor. We're not supposed to care about the earth that God has given us. We only care about a woman's medical procedure. And again, you would have thought I dropped my chores and chat on the floor. He was mortified and angry, and he went zero to batshit in a heartbeat. And that's when I went, and you're a man of God,
right?
And that's when my faith started to waver.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair. I could talk to you about the 2000 election and the abortion issue for probably 2 hours. But let's move away
eventually
from that.
Eventually, we got to eat dinner, Miles.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I'll tell you what. I mean, the first time that I ever had a question about, because I mean, when I was growing up, and I mean, church is just kind of what you did. My dad was a part of the church, and it was just like, you know, that's just part of my life and what we did. But the first time that I was ever like, this doesn't seem right, was when I think it's your sister-in-law was going to be married to another woman. and it was at a different church. Obviously, our church at the time was like very much so against gay marriage. And my mom wanted to go. And I remember my dad, he's mortified at this fact now, but I remember my mom and dad arguing about your sister-in-law's wedding because he said, I can't show my face there because of my job. And that was the first time I was like, that's really fucked up.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that was it. Go ahead.
That wedding was the beginning of the end of our relationship with St. John's. Was, but not that wedding, earlier than that.
Sure.
So Vicky's sister says to Vicky one day, can we go out and have dinner? I've got something I want to tell you. And, you know, Vicky left the house that night, basically, yeah, I know what this is, right? But we can, I'm glad she's finally, you know, coming to terms with it. Let's, you know,
sure.
And it was, she came out to Vicky and Vicky was like, duh. And we love you anyway. And we don't give a shit. Right. Well, not long after that, she told her parents and Arlen and Mary, of course, were just, they weren't
a tough conversation.
And what sucked was they didn't hesitate to tell everybody in the congregation.
Oh, so I had no idea.
Here's what I remember. I remember going to church on a Sunday with Tracy and us having a church. It's a good time. And then I remember like 2 weeks later going back to church. And those same people that 2 weeks before would have come up to Tracy and been like, oh, it's so lovely to see you. Not a peep.
Oh, God. Nobody talked. That breaks my heart.
Nobody talked to her. And that's when I realized this is too conservative for what I believe. And then it only got worse after the fire.
Yep.
And that's when things really went south with your dad.
Right. Yep.
I was on the board for redesigning the, I don't know what they call it, basically the kitchen and the fellowship hall. I was part of the board for that. And we had a conversation regarding, you know, this should only be women, is what I was told in this board meeting. Women have run the kitchen at St. John's forever, and it needs to only be women. And I'm like, well, I've got a culinary degree. I've done some restaurant design work. I feel like I have something I could offer. But if you don't want me here, that's fine. And it morphed from that into, why don't they allow women to preach? What is this? Why are women lesser than men in this faith? Mm-hmm. I have yet to meet a woman I didn't think was smarter than damn near every man I've ever met in my life. And why are we hamstringing ourselves like this? And that, those three things, right? The unwelcomeness I felt in that committee, the way they treated Tracy when her true self came to light, and the fact that they were never going to allow. And I remember talking to your dad about it. I don't know if he will ever remember this conversation. It was such a small moment in time, mm-hmm. but I expressed to him that I was struggling with my faith, as a friend, not as a pastor, you know, but as Joe to Don, you know, and he told me that he would rather be a member of a church that stood for something and had values and values that mattered, right? Than a church that went, you know what, if you ask for forgiveness, everything will be forgiven, right? And I saw that as well on some level, but that's when it occurred to me that God doesn't care about any of this nonsense. Right. He just cares that you're kind. And that you take care of those people that are suffering and poor and hungry and those that are less fortunate than ourselves. Do that and you're there. You're doing exactly what he wants you to do. And that, yeah, that ended that relationship. We went to an evangelical Lutheran church, First Lutheran in DeKalb, and then Bethlehem Lutheran. And we loved that vibe. We loved what they preached. We loved that, you know, accept Jesus into your heart and everything's going to be all right. And we've never left because that's where we have felt most at home. We did First Lutheran for a little bit. The congregation was too large. we went to Bethlehem Lutheran for the pastor, who was a lot like your dad, very outgoing. Loved that man, but he went on to bigger things with the synod. And one day Blake says, you know, it was time for confirmation. And Blake said, can I do confirmation at Salem? I have friends that go there. And we were like, sure. So we called Salem up and they said, of course he's welcome. Everybody's welcome. And we said, you know, great. And we've been there ever since. So Blake was 11. So we've been there 10 years, I guess.
That's awesome. That's good. I mean, good for you guys, honestly, for I guess, recognizing that and doing something about it. Because I think a lot of people stay. I mean, and there's a lot of people that, you know, my mom is one of them, honestly, where it's just like, you know, you're talking about the ladies in the kitchen. Like my great grandma was one of those ladies.
She certainly so was.
The lineage that we have in that church is still ingrained in her, and she's not able to give that up because of that connection. And if you have the connection, it's tough. And so, I mean, good on you guys for sticking to your values, no matter the values of the church. I think that's amazing. And I tell you what, like hearing that story about my dad and what he said to you, he's going to be so mortified that he was even speaking in that way about something that's so personal to somebody else. Like today he's a completely different person, and he would be mortified. I don't have another word for it. I mean, it's incredible to see that transition.
That makes me sad because I would not want your dad. I didn't take it poorly.
I don't think it's sad. I don't think it's sad. I think it's a good view of someone that's gone through transition, whether it's yourself, whether it's my dad, whether it's me, knowing that you can grow and you can look back on your former self and be like, ooh, you know, whether or not it's like you said what you said, and it can be mortifying and also good at the same time. And so when I say that, I say it with like a tinge of, you know, humility and you know, kind of the funny that comes out in that, but also like, it's awesome too, to see where he's at today and know just how down the rabbit hole he was from that religion is extremely interesting.
And I think you just hit the nail on the head. You see your dad all the time. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the man in years. And then it was only for 5 minutes. You know, I remember I have not seen your dad with any regularity since I dropped him off at rehab. And right. I remember dropping, taking him out there.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
I bailed him out, you know, and drove him out there and I hugged him and I said, anything you need, dude. You know, the things that are going on with you right now, they don't matter.
Right.
What the way the man was treated, I'll never forgive. I can't.
Yeah.
From my in-laws, we turned our back on a man that was hurting. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't feel a little bit of guilt about that.
No, I don't think so, man. I think that the world is very, very different from when my dad had his struggles to where it is now, where talking about things like addiction 10, 15 years ago was, you know, I think there's a comedian that says it's the only disease that you can get yelled at for having. If you have cancer, no one's going to yell at you. If you have alcoholism, you're going to get yelled at, you know? And yeah, I think that. True. Understanding that and understanding how far we've come is important. And dude, you did so much, man. Like I there was no one else at that time that could do the things that you had done to help him. And even doing those things that might seem little to you were massive for him and for our family. He might still be in jail, honestly. You know, like we didn't have the resources to go do. And for those that don't know, like he had 3 DUIs in a month at that time in Illinois. He had 3 DUIs in a month. He went to jail. And so I think that I understand that guilt, but also like it's the times are different, man. Like they just are.
I get it. But it goes back to the whole thing with Tracy. You know?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
God wants us to love everybody. Right. And I get it. People were angry at your dad for the way he conducted himself and the way that disease manifested itself in his actions. I completely understand that. Mm-hmm. But you don't, you know, I, I've been angry at my son before, but I will never turn my back on him. I won't, you know, no matter how bad it would get. Not, you know, he's a great kid. It's never been bad, but I just can't imagine turning my back on someone that I care about, regardless of the struggle. And I feel like dropping him off and hugging him and saying, if you need anything, we're here. And then basically dropping out of his life was a failure on my part. Because I should have, you know, you make time for things that are important, Miles. I've made time for my kids for years. I should have made more time for those friends that mattered to me, but something in your brain goes, well, they're fighting something else that you're not going to help with. Let them get through that. And before you know it, fucking 30 years have gone by and you've done nothing.
Well, so, you know, again, you did a lot. I want to reemphasize that. And I think, I hope that you're able to come to a point someday where you can recognize how much you helped myself, my mom, my sister, and also my dad. And, you know, maybe he needed that, you know, honestly, like the rock bottom thing is not a euphemism. It's like you have to hit rock bottom. And even after he was in that situation that he was in, that wasn't it. Like there was still further to go. And sometimes sometimes you just need people to, sometimes it just is a wake up call, man. You know, sure. Whether or not you have, like, support can only go so far. Like, I've had it up to here with him several times in my life. And we've talked about that at length with him and I. And so I hope you can get to a point where you don't feel that guilt, because the amount that you did was immense, for sure.
I don't know that it's guilt as much as it's anger. And it's anger. Ooh,
that's fair. That's fair.
At the church for turning their back on somebody who needed them, even though that's shit on them. That's, what he did wasn't good. We all get that. But you turn your back on him.
Yeah.
You know, you're people of God. Jesus is all about forgiveness and help and redemption and all of those things. And you said, fuck that. This guy's pissed me off. I'm not doing it. Right. And that makes me angry. And I think when I turn the anger on myself is I let it happen. I was meek. And Jesus wants us to be meek. Great. I was too meek. I should have stood up and said, you're all hypocrites. Fuck you. And I didn't. And I don't know why I didn't. And maybe I was angry. I don't know. But,
I'm sure you were.
One way or another, it's not guilt. I love your father to this day. If he called me right now and said, hey, Joe, I need to talk to you. Can we go grab a bite to eat? I yes. Let me get my shoes on. You know, where am I meeting you? But, water under the bridge, as they say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's to see the emotion coming out in you just speaking about my dad is I mean, that's awesome in and of itself. And I appreciate you as a person. I mean, I don't want to, we spent a lot of time on my dad. I want to talk about
good. I got all the time you need.
So where are you today? So we talked about, the anger that we've got with, the church that we were at, the church that my dad was a pastor at, to a point where, your son has said, hey, Salem is a place where my friends are. It jives with where we are, from a socially and politically, family, whatever it might be. Like, your faith today though, where does that, what does that look like for you?
So I have to talk about a couple of things then. Thing one would be my daughter, Abby. I don't know if you've ever met her. I know we're friends on Facebook. You may see.
Yeah, I've seen the progression of sure. that. Yeah.
So when she was 8 days old, she suffered a stroke. That was in that time period where I was more angry at church than anything. So I really, we hadn't found a whole lot. I was kind of a wayward boat. And so she has this stroke. We don't know it's a stroke at the time. We just know that she keeps stopping breathing, and we get her into the ambulance and we get her to Kishwaukee Hospital. And right in front of us, her breathing stops and her heart stops. Oh. So they call a code. And I remember turning to Vicky, because there were 15 people in that room in seconds. And I remember turning to say something to Vicky, but she had slid down the wall and she was on the floor silently crying. The anguish was, strong. They didn't realize we were in the room. So they're like, when the head guy, the head doctor realizes that, he's like, what in the hell are the parents doing in here? Right. Get them out of here. Right. So they came and they took us to the chapel, and we're sitting in the chapel. It's so quiet. And I remember looking at it, just circling back to, you know, August 2nd, 1990, I look at Vicky and she has got her hands in front of her and she is just praying her ass off.
Mm-hmm.
Yet again, who do I pray to? Right. I'm so angry at all this other stuff. I'm fighting battles for Tracy. I'm fighting battles internally for your dad. I'm fighting battles for myself and what I see as injustice or wrong. And I'm like, I got to give it something. Right. So I clasped my hands and I said, you know, listen, dude, we don't have the best relationship. It's pretty hot and cold. And I know you probably hear from people all the time asking you for help that don't deserve it. And I probably don't deserve it, but I'm not asking you for me. I'm asking you for her. And about 45 minutes later, a doctor came in the door and he says, we got her back.
Oh my God.
She's too small for us to take care of. So we're going to fly her to Children's. You guys can't ride with her. It's a flight nurse, you know, the baby, the pilots. They're taking her to Wheaton, you know, get there when you get there, just get there safely. And we'll go from there. And I remember not long ago, again, having a little bit of a crisis of faith and Vicky looking at me saying, I saw you praying. Who were you praying to? And it occurred to me that he's always been there in my life. And, I know he's there. I don't know how he works. I don't truly know what he wants. But you know what? If I can help in any way, I will. And so that took us a little bit closer to church. Now, our church now, Salem Lutheran in Sycamore, right across from Culver's, we have a pastor, Preston Fields, who is in a committed and loving relationship with another man.
Oh, wow. And that, I had no idea.
That is not something that St. John's ever would have allowed. Obviously, right? And he's fucking wonderful. He makes me want to go to church, right? That guilt comes when I don't go. I haven't been to church in months. But he makes me want to go. I can't justify not going. I'm off on weekends now. There's nothing stopping me from going if I want to go to church.
Right.
I just don't. And I don't know why. And the guilt resurfaces, but now it's more of guilt of, I really want to see Preston. You know, when he preaches it, he makes me happy. He has stories to tell and he's got life experiences that I find really interesting. And I cannot for the life of me understand why I don't go more often. But there it is. I mean, when we go to church, we go to Salem. We're happy there. There's, you know, we have no doctrinal issues. There's nothing, you know, there's always going to be those little inner church politics that you see, yeah. But I'm not in the church enough to have felt those yet. Very weird, by the way. You look just like your father when you're sitting behind that microphone and stuff, like, oh my God, I'm talking to Don. But so we're there. Abby is getting confirmed in September. It was a good 3 years. And like I said, I was one of her group leaders last year. They want me to be a group leader this year. Vicky and I are arguing. She doesn't want me to do it. She's like, you don't have the time. And I'm like, what else am I going to do on a Wednesday night for 2 hours? It's a good church. I do worry about churches because attendance just keeps, you know, I think more and more people are, you know, if they're, these small churches are dying out and instead you're getting, you know, 20,000 congregants at these mega churches where it's, you know, God hates gays and abortion is murder and, you know, all the stupid nonsense I know to be untrue. Mm-hmm. And that concerns me, but, yeah, we are happily at Salem. And I really would like to make an effort to go a little bit more often, because when I leave church, I feel pretty good about myself. No matter what else is going on, I tend to leave church in a much more positive frame of mind than I was when I went into church. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like a therapy session, you're able to clear your mind and learn a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. But, like meditation, you know, it's just a meditative session.
That's right. And that's where we're at, brother. That's what we do.
I love that. This was absolutely amazing. You gave me more than I ever thought I would get out of your story.
You underestimated me.
I think I estimated you just fine. I just think that you're just a great storyteller, number one, and number two, like to see your journey and know the heartache you've experienced, the trouble, you know, at a young age, and just to see where you're at today. I mean, you're just such a joyful person. That's amazing. Regardless of if we're going to disagree on religion in the future, if we have more conversations, but I love talking to you, and I'm sad it took us this long to get together.
Well, it will not take us this long to get back, because I will reach out to you to play some golf. We'll try to get out before the season ends this year.
Let's do it.
Are you in Sycamore?
No, I'm actually up in Madison, Wisconsin. So not too far away. Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's right on State Street, right down on campus.
Right on. Don't say the name. Don't say the name.
I won't. blur all that out. I will. Next time I'm going up there, man, I'll text you and see. I'll just throw my sticks in the trunk and maybe I can be there in the morning and you and I can hit some in the afternoon.
Hawks Landing Golf Course is where I belong, so I'll take you up there and we'll have a day.
Let's do it, brother. I'm all about that life.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for doing this, Joe. All the best to you and your family, and we'll definitely be seeing more of each other.
I appreciate you, my friend. Have a great day.
Thanks, man. Another huge, huge thank you to Joe Ross for coming on, sharing his story, and being vulnerable. It was just a fascinating conversation to have with him. Next week, our guest is Reverend Preston Fields. Here's a sneak peek.
That's the basic thing about being a pastor. I mean, there's a lot of boring administrative things that I do. There's a lot of really kind of intense things that we do. You know, I'm coming off, if I look a little tired, I've had kind of a string of funerals in the last two weeks that have just been really hard. But as much as it's hard, it's a privilege to be there. And then I get to baptize babies and witness weddings and celebrate with people as well. So, you know, leading worship, the sacraments, that's the very core of my identity. And I'm called a minister of word and sacrament. So if all else fails, that's what I do, preach the word and help facilitate the sacraments. But then everything else. I met my husband. I had, you know, been kind of not out while I was working in the youth ministry for sure. And finally met this person that I started thinking, gosh, this might be who I would spend the rest of my life with. And I actually went to a Catholic church that was kind of progressive. And I would say if I hadn't been called to ministry and I had stayed in Knoxville, this one particular parish probably would have welcomed me and my family. But awesome. I had this extra piece where I was being called to ministry. So anyway, I started doing that.
That's next time on Finding My Religion. Friendly reminder, if you haven't already subscribed, rated, or reviewed the show, please do so. It helps others find the show and lets me know if we are doing the right thing for your earballs. See you next week.